taken their fear of life to the extreme and turned it into a morbid, macabre, and murderous love affair with death. A love they insist the whole world share. Chapter 7. The Death-Centeredness of the Atheists. In the Gospels, Christ identifies himself with life and says of his mission, quote, "I have come so that they may have life and have it more abundantly," end quote. In the book of Proverbs, we see the converse is also true. Quote, "All who hate me, God, love death," end quote. This simple but eerie dictum is found throughout Scripture, and we'll discuss it more a little later in this book when we talk about the real motivation at the heart of the atheist movement. For now, though, it's enough to say that there is a profound and fundamental connection between atheism and death. At first, this might seem illogical. After all, one would think that since atheists do not believe in an afterlife, they would do all they could to prolong this life. One would think that because they don't believe in a hereafter, they would do all they could to defend, protect, and treasure life in the here and now. Alas, this is not the case. Indeed, the opposite is true. At the end of the last chapter, we concluded with a provocative remark that atheists have a love affair with death. The truth is even stranger and more frightening. For atheists today lust after death. Their whole outlook is pervaded by death. Their actions drip with death. Once again, we need to get some historical context in order to understand the morbidly bizarre death-centered agenda of the modern-day atheist. We've already talked about the important atheist and anti-Christian philosophers of the 18th and 19th centuries, men like Voltaire, Rousseau, Marx, Freud, Feuerbach, and Nietzsche. The critical point to grasp about these thinkers is that their writings, while revolutionary, did not permeate into the general culture until after they were dead. The vast majority of the people who lived at the time these men were expounding their views remained steadfastly Christian. In the years following Nietzsche's death in 1900, however, the atheistic philosophy of such thinkers began to find its way into the literature of the nations of the world. People such as Julian Huxley in England, John Dewey in America, Ernst Haeckel in Germany, and Jean-Paul Sartre in France are typical of the philosophers who agreed with the author of Beyond Good and Evil, that the Christian faith was the greatest enemy of humanity. Nietzsche's disciple John Dewey, for example, is the recognized father of American education. His 50 books have penetrated every facet of our modern school system. The point is, atheism today is not a minority position, as some would think. On the contrary, in most developed countries, atheistic thinking has already achieved relative dominance. Granted, not everyone in these societies uses the word atheist to describe their philosophy, but that's merely a linguistic point. The popular atheism of both Europe and North America is very much a practical form of unbelief. It's not so much the intellectual denial of God, although that is becoming more and more fashionable, but rather the moral exclusion of God from one's life. In other words, while many people stop short of calling themselves atheists, they simultaneously reject the majority of dogmas held by Judaism, Christianity, and other world religions. The bottom line is that whether a culture is called atheistic isn't nearly as important as whether the culture behaves in an atheistic way. According to Philip Kutcher, quote, "A functional atheist is someone who behaves as an atheist regardless of any religious beliefs the person may have. The combination of science and technology makes for a functionally atheistic culture, for a culture in which religions have comparatively little relevance. So long as people tend at work and at home to set aside rather than to act on their religious beliefs in any significant way, these people might as well be called atheists even if they don't like the word atheist. These people are functional atheists because they live in secular societies in which the prime movers aren't religious institutions, but secular ones. End quote. For the last century or so, we have lived in a predominantly secular and functionally atheistic society, or at the very least, one that is quickly moving in that direction. The government, the media, the academic world, the entertainment industry, the medical profession and others have all set aside their religious beliefs in favor of secular values. They are, for all practical purposes, atheistic in their culture. The average Hollywood movie star, for instance, doesn't have a clue about the philosophy of Nietzsche or Feuerbach. But by living a hedonistic lifestyle, by aggressively rejecting Judeo-Christian morality, and by adopting a purely secular system of values, these celebrities are essentially acting as functional atheists. This is a critically important point to understand, because at the same time the culture has embraced a fundamentally atheist mentality, it has also embraced what has been famously called a culture of death. This is no mere coincidence. The two cultures are inextricably connected. The term culture of death first entered common usage after Pope John Paul II mentioned it several times in his 1995 encyclical Evangelium Vitae, Latin for the Gospel of Life. In this encyclical, John Paul II wrote about the intrinsic value of every human life, which he said must be welcomed and loved from conception to natural death. The encyclical warned that the value of human life was fast eroding, and that modern culture had come to consider human life as merely a means to some other end, such as efficiency or economic productivity or personal convenience, and not solely an end or good in itself. The encyclical further warned that we were now in the midst of a new cultural climate, in which abortion, euthanasia, and other anti-life practices such as human sterilization, capital punishment, contraception, and embryonic stem cell research on aborted babies are being justified as rights in the name of individual freedom. Indeed, the Pope said that our culture has become deeply attracted to death. He said that these crimes against life are, quote, in a certain sense, a war of the powerful against the weak. A life which would require greater acceptance, love, and care is now considered useless or held to be an intolerable burden and is therefore rejected, end quote. This dire situation, he wrote, quote, ought to make us fully aware that we are facing an enormous and dramatic clash between good and evil, death and life, the culture of death, and the culture of life, end quote. Essentially, the Pope was saying that death has become the cure-all solution to the problems of the world. Instead of employing love and care and sacrifice to deal with difficulties, which can be painful for us to do, we now simply choose to kill our problems, literally. The Catholic Church declared John Paul II a saint in 2014. But many people in today's secular society disagree, dismissing the Pope as a right-wing religious fanatic. Some even call him a monster. Recall how Christopher Hitchens said the same of that other great saint of the 20th century, Mother Teresa. But what is the truth? Was the Pope correct in his assessment of the culture, or not? A quick look at some statistics gives us the answer. We saw in Chapter 3 that atheist leaders bear the blame for the vast majority of fatalities caused by war and mass murder in history. Indeed, between the years 1917 and 2007, approximately 148 million people were killed by atheist political regimes. During that time, the overall numbers of murders has increased dramatically as well. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime regularly conducts a global study on homicide, and for the last several years, the average number of intentional homicides in the world has been approximately 450,000 per year. The number of suicides is even more shocking. According to the World Health Organization, more than 800,000 people kill themselves annually. The website suicide.org puts the number even higher at more than a million, with one person taking his or her own life every 40 seconds. The New York Times, as well as the American Society for Suicide Prevention, report that the suicide rate in the United States has surged to its highest levels in 3 decades, with nearly 45,000 people dying from self-inflicted causes each year. According to USA Today, there is a suicide in this country every 13 minutes. Regarding abortion, the statistics are truly horrifying. Since the 1960s, there have been more than 1 billion abortions worldwide. That is roughly equivalent to 1/7 the total population of the planet. The most recent and conservative studies show the annual worldwide number of abortions to be 12.4 million. However, the Guttmacher Institute, which was originally founded by Planned Parenthood and is now an independent research and policy organization committed to, quote, advancing sexual and reproductive health and rights in the United States and globally, end quote, in a May 2016 report, estimated the number of global abortions to be an astonishing 56.3 million per year. In America alone, since the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973, more than 60 million abortions have taken place. This is roughly equivalent to 1/3 of the entire generation conceived in the United States since abortion was legalized. The abortion death toll in the United States is now approximately 1 million per year. New York City has the highest abortion rate in the country. According to a recent Center for Disease Control and Prevention abortion surveillance report, New York City reported 69,840 abortions and 116,777 registered births, which means that city's abortion rate is 60% of its birth rate. It's estimated that 92% of all women in the world who receive a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome abort their babies. In many countries, laws allow mothers to terminate their unborn children simply because they are the wrong gender, that is, not the gender they prefer. In some countries, abortion is compulsory for couples who already have the state-allowed number of offspring. In China, for instance, that number had been 1 for many years, but was increased to 2 in late 2015. Horror stories abound of women who had their babies forcibly aborted at 7, 8, and even 9 months of pregnancy because they had violated this law. No matter what your position on the abortion issue, it's an undeniable fact that in the last 50 years, the same time society's become so secularized and atheistic, there has been a historically unprecedented number of terminated pregnancies. Indeed, the atheist-abortion connection has been established in other ways as well. According to a recent Gallup poll, Americans with no religious attachment, self-proclaimed atheists, agnostics, and those with simply no religious preferences, identify themselves as pro-choice rather than pro-life by a 68% to 19% margin. 49 percentage points. This represents the strongest propensity toward the pro-choice position of any major U.S. demographic group. At the other end of the life spectrum, during this same functionally atheistic era, we've also seen a corresponding worldwide acceptance and legalization of assisted suicides and involuntary euthanasia. For example, the use of euthanasia and assisted suicide to prematurely end the life of an adult with a terminal illness is now routine across the globe. Euthanasia is increasingly being used on those who are mentally ill. Since euthanasia was legalized in the Netherlands in 2002, its use has risen 73%, with some 25,000 people killed. Mobile euthanasia teams now routinely kill approximately 1,000 people per year in their homes. In Belgium and the Netherlands, people can choose to die if they have a terminal illness, depression, or just a feeling that their lives are incomplete. In one case in Holland, a 41-year-old man was euthanized with the assistance of his physician because he couldn't stop drinking. Euthanasia is increasingly being used on children who are terminally ill. It is legal for physicians to euthanize children at the age of 12 in the Netherlands and minors of all ages in Belgium. Recently, a family in the Netherlands was cleared of any wrongdoing for holding down an elderly woman who struggled desperately against the doctor's efforts to euthanize her. Her crime, it seems, was wandering around her nursing home at night and exhibiting signs of dementia. In the United States, the Right to Die movement has grown increasingly more powerful. 6 states currently permit euthanasia, and many other states are considering it as well. The favored method of mercy killing is the involuntary removal of sustenance from patients. Recall the drawn-out, court-ordered death by starvation and dehydration of Terry Schiavo. In states where euthanasia is legal, it is increasingly being encouraged. Stories abound of people whose physicians recommend against assisted suicide, only to have other doctors, who know little of the patient's histories, write fatal prescriptions for them. In at least one case in Oregon, a woman's insurance would not pay for her to continue her fight against lung cancer, but helpfully noted that it would pay for assisted suicide. Another man in Oregon was denied a life-extending drug, but was notified that the state health plan would pay to kill him. Again, no matter where you stand on the issue of euthanasia, there can be no question that these are frightening and dangerous times for anyone who is hospitalized or seriously sick. Yet, prominent atheists are unabashedly vocal and callous about their commitment to an across-the-board pro-death agenda. When, for example, a woman on Twitter asked leading atheist Richard Dawkins what she should do in the event she became pregnant with a Down syndrome baby, Dawkins immediately responded, quote, "Abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice," end quote. He later elaborated that it was wrong to have the baby, quote, "from the point of view of the child's own welfare," end quote. Dawkins' reasoning was that the life of someone with Down syndrome would be too full of difficulties to be worth the effort of the parents. It would be much more humane to kill it. In other words, in Dawkins' view, it is an ethical imperative to abort a mentally handicapped baby, both for the sake of the world and for the child's own individual sake. Many parents of children with Down syndrome were understandably upset when they heard Dawkins' advice. One father sent a heartfelt public letter to the atheist, which read, quote, "Perhaps you believe that your position on abortion and Down syndrome is logically valid, but I wonder if you're kept awake at night by the revulsion that comes with being the champion of killing. Suffering is not a moral evil to be avoided. Suffering can have meaning and value. Ask Viktor Frankl, or Mahatma Gandhi, or Martin Luther King Jr., or, if you're willing, ask my children. I have 2 children with Down syndrome. They're adopted. Their birth parents faced the choice to abort them and didn't. Instead, the children came to live with us. They're delightful children. They're beautiful. They're happy. One is a cancer survivor, twice over. I found that in the hospital, as she underwent chemotherapy and we suffered through agony and exhaustion, our daughter Pia was more focused on befriending nurses and stealing stethoscopes. They suffer, my children, but in the context of irrepressible joy," end quote. Why is there such a difference in thinking here? Why do atheists like Dawkins believe that this man's children, and all other children like them, should have been aborted rather than allowed to live, even when the parents are willing to love and care for them? How can we make sense of the atheist's preference for death over love, acceptance, and sacrifice? In order to understand their rationale, we need to dig deeper into the philosophy of atheism. There are 3 strains of atheistic thought that keep popping up in this audiobook. All of them can help to illuminate the atheist approach to subjects like homicide, suicide, infanticide, abortion, and euthanasia. Let's take them one by one. First, atheists believe that since there is no God, there can be no such thing as objective and eternal values. Everything is transient. Yes, there can be practical preferences, but nothing truly universal or transcendent. Therefore, the only sensible goals for human beings to strive after are worldly pleasures, conveniences, and the elimination of all suffering. If someone or something happens to stand in the way of the attainment of those objectives, it is perfectly acceptable and even praiseworthy to do whatever is necessary to eliminate that threat. Second, since there is no God for the atheist, no objective and eternal moral law can exist. Without objective moral law, human beings are free to become, again, in Nietzsche's phrase, supermen. Unfettered by silly commandments and the guilt that comes from breaking them, humans are at liberty to make their own laws, that is, whatever laws happen to suit them at the time. They themselves can define what constitutes a valuable life, and even life itself, defining people, killing, and mercy according to their own standards as they go. For Nietzsche and his atheist followers, the most important value in the world is power. Therefore, life is always subordinate to choice, and the choice made by the strong to dominate the weak, who usually stand in the way of pleasure and convenience, is always the correct course of action. Third, atheists believe that since there is no God, it is nonsense to believe that human beings are made in the image and likeness of God. Indeed, humans are not special at all. Rather, they are expendable animals, essentially monkeys with bigger brains. They possess neither God-given immortal souls, nor any kind of inherent or infinite dignity. They simply represent one biological animal among many biological animals. Therefore, protecting their existence is not particularly important. Humans can be oppressed by cruel governments, murdered, aborted, and euthanized at any age and for any reason, as long as it serves some greater practical purpose, which, of course, is always determined by whomever happens to be strongest at the moment. These three primary ideas drive the ethical philosophy of atheism. They are not difficult to understand, yet modern atheists do their best to mislead people about them because the vision of the world they imply is nothing short of terrifying. Remember what we said in the last chapter about this new breed of atheists. Unlike their predecessors, they constantly resort to lies. They have to do this because they are too cowardly to admit the logical implications of their thinking. They understand that the language used by Nietzsche is repugnant to most people. They understand that the three strains of thought I just described can be frightening and, if applied correctly, deadly. So instead of boldly proclaiming them, they choose to ignore or deny them, or even worse, like Dawkins, hide behind the falsehood that they are only being compassionate to those who are suffering. And yet, once we look past the lies and try to really grasp the fundamental principles of atheistic thought, the whole culture of death makes perfect sense. It makes sense, for instance, that the Supreme Court of the United States would take it upon itself to redefine what a human person is and legalize abortion, a practice that had been considered barbaric by all peoples and nations for thousands of years. That is the logical implication of atheist thinking, which says we can choose to do anything we like, including decide what human life is and destroy the weakest and most vulnerable among us. It makes sense that institutions like Planned Parenthood would become involved in scandals involving the harvesting and selling of fetal organs and other aborted baby parts. That is the logical implication of atheist thinking, which says that because human beings have no transcendent dignity, we can utilize or discard their bodies in any way that might be profitable to us. It makes sense that, in the 21st century, our society would do everything possible to encourage strength, fitness, diet, and longevity, while at the same time promote euthanasia and abortion for any or no medical reason at all. The healthy and long life is the atheist's sole definition of a worthwhile life. In the end, pleasure is their only measure. So naturally, when faced with a person whose life does not conform to that definition, for example, a baby with Down syndrome, an old man with dementia, a young woman with depression. The society is lightning quick to abort, euthanize, or assist in its suicide. That is the logical implication of atheist thinking, which says that the only thing that counts is the physical and empirical quality of life. Any talk about the deeper spiritual meaning of suffering, endurance, sacrifice, and joy is just religious nonsense. You see, once we understand the atheist philosophy of life, it becomes immediately clear why they have such a love affair with death. It also becomes clear what their agenda is for the future. And this is where things get really scary. Because when it comes to using death as a cure-all for human problems, atheists have only just scratched the surface. Consider the following examples. Many environmentalists today believe that human activity represents the greatest threat to the planet. An increasing number of them are now saying that the most effective solution to our ecological problems would be to dramatically reduce that threat through abortion and euthanasia. For example, in 2017, Michael Brun, the executive director of the Sierra Club, stated that abortion is an essential tool in protecting the environment from the, quote, threat of overpopulation, end quote. In the United Kingdom, Lord Shinquin, who is disabled, recently gave a stirring speech in the House of Lords, in which he talked about the disturbing trends in abortion law on the grounds of disability. He said, quote, "The writing is on the wall for people like me. People with congenital disabilities are facing extinction. If we were animals, perhaps we might qualify for protection as an endangered species. But we're only human beings with disabilities, so we do not," end quote. Currently, there is a strong push by euthanasia advocates to stop spoon-feeding Alzheimer's patients if they, quote, requested that in advance, end quote. Peter Singer, the well-known atheist and professor of bioethics at Princeton University, believes that doctors should be permitted to lethally inject Alzheimer's patients even if they never ask to be killed, because they qualify as, quote, non-persons, end quote. These are just some of the latest developments in our culture of death. They represent the first fruits of what is to come. After all, if human beings are no more than disposable commodities, abortion, euthanasia, and other methods of killing can be justified for any reason at all, including helping to alleviate overpopulation, immigration, poverty, homelessness, child abuse, and problems concerning race relations. In fact, if you really want to know the agenda of the new atheists, you only have to look back to the older and bolder atheists of the past, who weren't afraid to speak their minds about what they believed. Margaret Sanger, for instance, the founder of Planned Parenthood, enlisted proudly as a celebrity atheist and activist on the website celebatheist.com, said in her book, Women in the New Race, quote, "The most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its infant members is to kill it," end quote. She also laid out the following objectives in an article called America Needs a Code for Babies. Here's a tiny sampling. Article 1. The purpose of the American Baby Code shall be to provide for a better distribution of babies and to protect society against the propagation and increase of the unfit. Article 4. No woman shall have the legal right to bear a child, and no man shall have the right to become a father without a permit. Article 6. No permit for parenthood shall be valid for more than one birth. Miss Sanger, whose magazine slogan was "No gods, no masters," was an early proponent of eugenics, the science of improving the human population by controlled breeding for the purpose of increasing the occurrence of desirable characteristics and decreasing the negative traits in people. Recall, this was one of the Nazis' favorite fields of study. Sanger, still very much celebrated today as a heroine by Planned Parenthood, was not timid at all in proclaiming her belief that human reproduction had to be forcibly controlled and manipulated in order to weed out any undesirables. In her book, The Pivot of Civilization. She wrote that handicapped people, including the blind, deaf, dumb, mute, insane, and epileptic, represented the, quote, dead weight of human waste, end quote. In her view, we should, quote, apply a stern and rigid policy of sterilization and segregation to that grade of population whose progeny is tainted or whose inheritance is such that objectionable traits may be transmitted to offspring. The whole dysgenic population, people with bad genes, would have its choice of segregation or compulsory sterilization, end quote. Sanger also considered blacks to be an inferior race that had to be sterilized, controlled, and aborted out of existence. She stated, quote, if we can train the Negro doctor at the clinic, he can go among them with enthusiasm and with knowledge, which I believe will have far-reaching results among the colored people. The minister's work is also important, and also he should be trained, perhaps by the Federation, as to our ideals and the goal that we hope to reach. We do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members. End quote. This is a particularly chilling quote, given the fact that today, Planned Parenthood is extraordinarily active in African American communities. Indeed, a recent study by the group Protecting Black Life found that 79% of Planned Parenthood's surgical abortion facilities are located within walking distance of African American neighborhoods. In fact, African American babies in New York City have a better chance of dying in the womb than of being born, according to a report from the New York City Department of Mental Hygiene. On average, for every 1,000 black babies born in New York City every year, 1,200 are aborted. In Mississippi, 72% of the total number of abortions are performed on black babies. This, in a state where whites outnumber blacks by a ratio of 1.6 to 1. Margaret Sanger would undoubtedly be thrilled to know that her atheistic vision of a eugenically engineered society is at last coming true. And then there is infanticide. We can't end this discussion without talking briefly about the killing of babies that have already been born. In the Netherlands, this gruesome practice is already legal. Indeed, it is perfectly acceptable there for doctors and parents to jointly decide that quote-unquote desperately ill newborns can be killed shortly after birth. Likewise, postnatal abortion, as it is euphemistically called, for disabled children is now being considered in Canada. Udo Schuklenk, the well-known Canadian bioethicist, has stated, quote, once we have concluded that death is what is in the best interest of the infant, it is unreasonable not to bring about this death as painlessly and as much controlled in terms of timing by the parents as is feasible, end quote. And why shouldn't they think it unreasonable to bring about the death of newborns? If you redefine person as only those beings who are capable of rational thought and self-reflection, then not only are fetuses and embryos not persons, but neither are infants. Atheist Professor John Harris, perhaps the most highly respected member of the British Medical Association's Ethics Committee, wholeheartedly agrees. On numerous occasions, he has stated that infanticide is quote-unquote justifiable because it is simply not, quote, plausible to think that there is any moral change that occurs during the journey down the birth canal, end quote. In other words, there is no moral difference between aborting a fetus and killing a baby. Atheist researchers Alberto Giubilini and Francesca Minerva add to the chorus of unbelievers calling for the legalization of baby killing. In their paper, After Birth Abortion, Why Should the Baby Live?, they make the following argument. 1. Both fetuses and newborns do not have the same moral status as an actual person. 2. The fact that both are potential persons is morally irrelevant. And 3. adoption is not always in the best interest of actual people. Therefore, they conclude, after-birth abortion, killing a newborn, should be permissible in all the cases where abortion is, including cases where the newborn is not disabled. All cases, including where the newborn is not disabled. Are you listening to these words carefully? They are not made up. They are not the product of religious paranoia. They come from the mouths of some of today's leading atheists. This is where our culture is going. This is where the new atheists are taking us, to a world where ending life is the answer to every problem, a world where killing is always preferable to love and sacrifice, a world where eugenics, abortion, fetal harvesting, euthanasia, assisted suicide, forced suicide, and infanticide are all practiced all the time for all reasons. This is the future. We have to wake up and face facts. If the Bible says that God's primary motive is to bring forth life, then the dark, twisted, and morbid motto of the modern atheist movement is just the opposite. We have come that you may have death and have it more abundantly. And as we'll see in the next chapter, not only are the atheists deadly serious about making their ghoulish vision a reality, but they have all the faith and religious fervor necessary to accomplish it. Chapter 8. The Faithfulness of the Atheists. Believers have always claimed that atheism not only takes faith, but is a faith. Atheists, of course, scoff at this notion, just as they scoff at everything believers say. When it comes to rational argument, atheists will ridicule, mock, jeer, sneer, scorn, dismiss, deride, and hide. They'll do anything except argue rationally. And that's a pity, because the assertion that atheism requires faith is a fascinating paradox that deserves discussion. When believers make that claim, they mean it. They're not being facetious in any way. They know what they're talking about because it's their business to know about faith. They know the difference between belief and knowledge. Atheists do not. Of course, they say they do. In fact, atheists make the ridiculous claim that they have no beliefs whatsoever regarding God. They say they merely lack belief in Him. In other words, they define atheism not as something positive, but rather something negative, as the absence of belief, an absence that is due to a lack of evidence. And isn't that so convenient? If atheism were merely the absence of belief, then atheists would never have to defend their position. After all, if a position is really a non-position, there is no corresponding intellectual obligation to respond to any criticism of it. And that's what atheists love most, a phony, strawman, non-discussion. It makes perfect sense. If you're ignorant, shallow, and cowardly to begin with, the last thing you want to do is defend your thinking on rational grounds. Better to avoid intellectual debate altogether and stick to what you know best, taunting, sneering, and scoffing. But they're not going to get away with that here. If this book has shown anything at all, it's that atheism is the furthest thing in the world from an absence of belief. Indeed, atheism is a whole system of beliefs, a system that has its own philosophy, materialism, morality, relativism, politics, social Darwinism, and culture, secularism. It even has its own sacraments, abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia. And this system of beliefs has been responsible for more death, carnage, persecution, and misery than any system of beliefs the world has ever known. So no, atheists won't get off scot-free by calling what they so fervently believe mere unbelief. They can't hold out their hands in mock innocence, feigning protest that they have nothing to prove, when those same hands are dripping with so much blood. They're going to be held to the same intellectual standard that they claim applies to people of faith. But before we get to the specifics of what atheists believe, let's first talk a little about faith itself. What exactly is this mysterious thing, and why do atheists treat it as such a dirty word? Essentially, faith is trust or confidence in something that has a strong basis in reason, but which can't be absolutely empirically proven. Faith is completely antithetical to superstition and fantasy, which have no rational basis whatsoever. Thus, you can't compare it to belief in Santa Claus, or the Tooth Fairy, or the Flying Spaghetti Monster, as so many atheists frivolously claim. True faith is always based on reason. Contrary to what atheists say, all human beings have faith of some kind. It's impossible to live in this world without it. For instance, every morning millions of people get up and drive to work. During their commute, nothing separates them from oncoming traffic except a thin white line. They pass all kinds of cars and trucks and trailers that are going more than 60 miles an hour and headed right toward them. They don't know the drivers of those vehicles. They have no clue about their driving records or whether or not any of them has a drinking problem. If just one of those drivers swerved a few feet, a crash would occur. Yet these commuters go merrily along without blinking as hundreds of vehicles whiz past them. How can they do that? They have faith that those other drivers will stick to their side of the road. When these folks get to work, it's the same story. They sit down at their desks, and above them is a big ceiling. They haven't ever inspected it. They haven't checked to see if the support beams are nailed in properly or if the wood has been eaten away by termites. They haven't checked to verify that all the building permits are in order. For all they know, the whole structure might suddenly collapse and crush them. And yet day after day, they sit in front of their computer screens without a care in the world. Why? Because they have faith that the people who built their offices were professionals who did everything they were supposed to do to make sure their working environment was safe. Almost all our knowledge of history is based on faith, too. Think about it. Were you around when the Romans conquered Carthage in 146 BC? Or when Columbus discovered America in 1492? Or when George Washington crossed the Delaware River in 1776? If you didn't actually see those events, how can you be so sure they ever took place? Oh, but there's evidence, you say. There are documents and books and testimonies and paintings. Yes, that's right. And that's the same kind of evidence on which people of faith based many of their religious beliefs. Whether you're talking about religion or the historical record of mankind, most of the information we have has been passed down to us from generation to generation. Very little of it is firsthand. Very little of it is scientifically provable. Most of it must be accepted on faith. Faith in the authors of the documents, faith in the reliability of the eyewitnesses, and faith in our ability to draw logical and rational conclusions from a whole range of data and evidence. The point is, faith is not some fanatical, fundamentalist, ultra-religious concept. It's a basic necessity for living in the world. And whether or not atheists admit it, they are just as dependent on it as everyone else. What are some of the things that atheists take on faith? G.K. Chesterton once said, quote, "When a man stops believing in God, he doesn't then believe in nothing. He believes in anything," end quote. And how true that is. There aren't enough pages in this book to describe all the faith-based beliefs that atheists hold dear to their hearts. But let's start with the most obvious, the assertion that God doesn't exist because there is no evidence for his existence. This is, of course, patently absurd. In chapter 1 of this book, we discuss some of the great thinkers in history who are also fervent believers. Those men and women had faith in a supreme being, not only because of their acceptance of the Bible as the Word of God, but also because of thoughtful, logical, and analytical reasoning. Indeed, there are dozens of rational arguments that demonstrate the existence of God, far too many to go over here. There is the cosmological argument, for instance, which explores the question, where did everything come from? There's the teleological argument, which points to the order and harmony of the universe and asserts that there must be some kind of designer. There are arguments that stem from notions of contingency, from desire, from degrees of perfection, from miracles, from morality and conscience, and from reliable testimonies. The list goes on and on. All of these are based on logic, on observation of the physical world and our own consciousness, or on inductive and deductive reasoning. None of them are based on Scripture. None of them attempt to prove God's existence merely by asserting that the Bible says this or that. The truth is, when atheists say there is no evidence for God, what they really mean is that there is no scientific evidence for his existence. That is an altogether different thing. For atheists to even make that claim demonstrates a belief in the power of science that is both exaggerated and irrational. Indeed, the assertion that something must be scientifically explicable or provable in order to be believed is in itself an article of faith. This belief, as we noted in chapter 5, is an intellectual fallacy known as scientism. It means the reduction of all legitimate knowledge to the scientific form of knowledge. And its fundamental problem, of course, is that it can't be proven scientifically. There's simply no way to empirically observe or experimentally verify the notion that truth can only be arrived at through scientific means. The whole proposition is therefore unscientific. It is an atheistic belief based solely on their faith in its truth, not on any scientific evidence. Indeed, the whole study of science would be impossible unless we made another huge unscientific assumption. We must first assume that the universe is intelligible, that it is understandable, that it is predictable to some degree, that it obeys the laws of reason, that it makes sense. Predictability and obedience to physical laws comprise the cornerstone of scientific inquiry. Without intelligibility, no scientific discussion could take place because you would never be able to trust the outcome of any of the experiments you conducted. You would also never be able to trust your own thought process or reasoning ability. And yet, the whole concept of intelligibility has not itself been scientifically proven. At its core, it is a faith-based assumption, a belief based on what appears to be the truth. Now again, there's nothing wrong with this. Like the other kinds of faith we've talked about, it's a necessary part of life. But atheists don't have the courage, honesty, or intelligence to admit it. Instead, they robotically rattle off the same self-delusional drivel. If it can't be scientifically proven, it's not true. And that's only the beginning of their faith. Remember, atheists believe that everything in life has a purely material basis. They completely deny the existence of the spiritual. They believe that our thoughts, dreams, passions, loves, hates, hopes, ambitions, virtues, sins, and sufferings are driven solely by atomic activity. They believe that all our philosophies, politics, cultures, art, literature, music, history, and deepest desires for eternal life, and all that is transcended in the world, the good, the true, and the beautiful, is purely the result of biochemical reactions and the random movement of molecules in an empty and lifeless ether. This isn't science. It's faith. What's more, it's an irrational faith that serves as the foundation for all superstition. But there's even more. Atheists make a whole slew of assumptions that can't be proven scientifically. For instance, they believe that this incredibly complex universe of ours, a universe of unparalleled beauty, harmony, and order, came about all by itself, out of nothing. They believe that organization came out of chaos, that life came out of lifelessness, that consciousness came out of non-consciousness, that reason came out of irrationality. None of these beliefs can be shown empirically. None can be demonstrated or replicated scientifically. None of them even makes sense. Of course, some atheists, the philosopher David Hume, for example, have denied that the universe is organized to begin with. And some very silly atheists still think that evolution somehow explains how life first began. But these beliefs are utterly unbelievable. To claim that the universe is chaotic and disorganized flies in the face of common sense. For instance, we all know that the moon orbits around the Earth in a perfect spiral, and the Earth circles the sun in a perfect spiral, and the sun circles the galaxy center in a perfect spiral. Billions of stars and billions of galaxies all move in similar and predictable spiral paths and with fixed trajectories. 90% of the observable matter in the universe acts in this highly organized way. To deny that the universe is organized is preposterous. Even a high school student with a telescope can see that. And as to the claim that evolution explains the origin of life, we've touched on this nonsensical notion before. The statistical odds that even the most elemental kind of life could arise as the result of a random mixing of molecules in some primordial soup are so astronomical that even scientists have trouble figuring them out. They can't say that the odds are trillions to one, because that figure is much too low. Dr. Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Center for Science and Culture of the Discovery Institute, argues that the probability of generating even a short functional protein, which is the simplest building block of life, is 1 in 10 to the 125th power, a number so infinitesimal as to defy description. It actually means 1 in 100 quadragintillion. To use a familiar analogy, if you took thousands of letters of the alphabet, threw them high up into the air, watched them all fall to the ground, and they somehow formed themselves into Tolstoy's War and Peace, that would be as likely to occur as life being formed by the chance mixing of molecules. That's why Dr. Meyer and his colleagues have concluded that there is a much greater probability of the existence of some kind of cosmic designer who engineered the creation of life on this planet. They say, quote, "The complex but functionally specified sequences in DNA imply the past action of an intelligent mind, even if such mental agency cannot be directly observed," end quote. Yet, despite the testimony of many respected scientists and mathematicians, atheists obstinately refuse to accept even the possibility that the universe had a designer. They steadfastly maintain the dogma that life on this planet had to come about by chance. Their position contradicts logic, contradicts experience, and even contradicts science itself. Yet they still believe it. That takes faith. Let's put it another way. Atheists scoff at Christians for believing that Christ could raise people from the dead because, according to their way of thinking, miracles aren't scientifically possible. But Christians accept the notion that Christ could raise people from the dead only because they also believe that Christ is God, and God is the supernatural creator of life. That belief requires faith, but at least it has a logical basis. Atheists, on the other hand, believe that life came from non-life, consciousness came from non-consciousness, and thought came from non-thought. Those are much more stupendous miracles than any of the Gospels report. But atheists won't concede that they're miracles. Their faith is so restrictive that it doesn't allow for the slightest deviation from the doctrine of materialism. The famous Christian writer and ex-atheist C.S. Lewis once said, quote, "If you are an atheist, you do have to believe that the main point in all the religions of the whole world is simply one huge mistake. If you are a Christian, you are free to think that all those religions, even the queerest ones, contain at least some hint of truth. When I was an atheist, I had to try to persuade myself that most of the human race have always been wrong about the question that mattered to them most. When I became a Christian, I was able to take a more liberal view." End quote. A more liberal view is something that is not open to atheists. They insist, solely on the basis of faith, that science will one day be able to explain all the mysteries and miracles of the universe. But science can't even figure out how to make a blade of grass. In fact, science can't even answer the most basic scientific questions. What is dark matter, for example? Or what is dark energy, which can't be seen or felt but somehow takes up 70% of the universe? Or how can light be made of both particles and waves at the same time? Or why does time only go in one direction? Or why can we only imagine three dimensions when so many more are suggested by string theory and other scientific theories? Or how can quantum mechanics and gravity live together? Or how can either one of them exist when black holes contradict both? These are legitimate scientific mysteries, and scientists don't have a clue as to their answers. Yet atheists continue to worship at the feet of science as though it's some kind of deity, propagating the mad illusion that it holds the key to unlocking all the secrets of the universe. The truth is, when it comes to the deepest mysteries of life, science will never have the answers. The reason we can be so sure is that questions having to do with the origin of the cosmos are philosophic in nature, not scientific. Elsewhere in this book, we quoted Albert Einstein, who said, quote, "The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mystical," end quote. The deeper we go into science, the more mysterious and mystical things become. And at its center lies the greatest mystery of all, the mystery of existence. Why is there something rather than nothing? This is the question of questions, the riddle of riddles, the enigma of enigmas, and atheists are completely in the dark about it. Let's pause here and really consider this point. It's crucial that we try to understand it, because it explains why atheists actually need more faith than believers. Logic and common sense dictate that something can't come from nothing. That much should be obvious to anyone. Therefore, the substance that makes up the cosmos, matter, couldn't have popped into existence spontaneously and by itself. There had to have been some original cause for it. That's why the Big Bang Theory, which, remember, was originally formulated by a Catholic priest, actually strengthens the argument for God's existence. For if the cosmos really did come about as a result of a massive explosion, then what kind of substance or force existed right before that explosion? What precipitated the explosion in the first place? Only the most ignorant of atheists would believe that nothing existed before the Big Bang. If they truly thought such a thing, they would be admitting that some kind of God ignited the blast. Because again, something can't come from nothing. Thus, any atheist with scientific sense must recognize that the Big Bang Theory only provides a possible explanation for how the present universe came about and might have developed. It does not give us any indication of the origin of the cosmos. Now, some scientists have postulated that gravity or some other force of nature caused everything to come into being. Other scientists have postulated the existence of a multiverse, which contained an inconceivably large number of universes that spontaneously created itself. Again, a theory for which there is no experimental or observational evidence. But none of these explanations addresses the original cause of those forces or that multiverse. None of them addresses the central question of existence itself. Any possible cause scientists theorize about must necessarily have been contingent on some other cause, which was also contingent on something else, continuing back in an infinite regress of contingent causes. Gravity, for example, had to come from somewhere. Therefore, none of these causes can be the true original cause. The bottom line is, everything points back to some mysterious reality that is not contingent or dependent on anything else. Some timeless reality whose very nature is to be. Some reality that can be defined as existence itself. Those atheists who have the brain power to grasp this concept understand that this mysterious, non-contingent reality has only one of two possible identities. Either it is God, whose nature is spiritual, or the cosmos, whose nature is material. In other words, either God or the cosmos always existed. There is no other choice. What does this mean for atheists? It means they have a big problem on their hands. It means they need faith. It means that, according to their own belief system, the cosmos has no beginning. Matter itself has no beginning. In other words, despite the fact that atheists don't believe in an eternal God, they still have to contend with the monumental mystery of eternal matter, a mystery that science can never hope to fathom. After all, how in the world can matter have no beginning? How can anything have no beginning? This is something even the greatest scientific geniuses can't wrap their minds around. It's not something that can be dismissed nonchalantly, as so many dull-witted atheists do today. Those who believe in God have the same mystery to contend with, but at least they have a rational foundation to grab hold of. They assert that it's possible for God, the creator of the cosmos, to have no beginning only because he